Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, this is Radio Lab. I'm Jad Abumrad. Today, some simple science. Two stories of incredibly simple scientific discoveries, one from modern times and the other right out of the past. To start, we're going to play a show that Molly Webster and Robert Krulwich did a few years back that at the time, this was 2016, was breaking news, but it also includes some updates that came out in about 2020. So I'm going to let them take it from here.
Hi, I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Molly Webster.
This is Radiolab, and today...
we've got breaking news, Robert Krulwich.
On break, this is something we've never done before.
Never done before.
Well, does anybody know about this yet?
Well, it is a new bit of research. It's being published today.
Uh-huh. What's this thing about?
Oh, this is a discovery about Alzheimer's disease, which I think at this point is something that affects basically every family.
Affected my family, yeah.
Yeah. And this is a discovery that is not a cure, but it's basically about looking at the brain, which is one of the most complicated things in the universe, I think, and poking at it in this super simple way and getting this bizarre result.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Molly.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, so last May, I was talking to some folks over at the Brain Institute at MIT, and while I was on the phone with them, they started telling me about some research that hadn't been published yet, so it was all very hush-hush. It was pretty cool, though. We ended up deciding to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and it was based on the work of this woman, Li-Wei Tai.
Li-Wei Tai, I'm a professor and the director of the PCOR Institute for Learning and Memory at MIT.
Holy crap, you're the director. How do you have time to do all of that?
I know, that's a good question.
She is like a badass is what she is.
But this is a piece of work I'm very proud of. So historically, people work on Alzheimer's really focus
so
a lot.
So I would say generally when you talk to researchers about Alzheimer's disease, they either focus on...
Individual genetic factors.
The genetics of the disease, so the genes that predispose you maybe to Alzheimer's.
Or...
the brain chemistry and how Alzheimer's affects the chemicals in the brain.
Molecular pathological features.
But in my conversation with Li-Wei, she was talking about something totally different.
We sort of look at it from a different angle.
Her work all centers around something called...
the gamma frequency.
The gamma frequency?
Mm-hmm.
Gamma.
And what is gamma? I'm like, it feels like something from Battlestar Galactica. So, I don't think it's that.
So, this gamma, so-called gamma...
you could think of it as a particular beat in your brain.
A beat in the brain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which means what exactly?
Well, just to oversimplify one of the most complicated things in the known universe.
Okay. Please do.
You've got your brain. It's full of neurons, which are a certain type of brain cell.
We have billions of neurons in the brain.
They have these long tentacles that are reaching out towards other neurons.
And for the brain to function, neurons have to communicate with each other to process information.
And the way they do that is they fire.
Yes.
An electrical signal will go through them and it'll like zap another neuron and it'll turn it on, and then an electrical signal will go through it and it'll zap another neuron and it'll turn it on. But the cool thing is that when your brain is doing things like making you move or write a poem or think great thoughts, groups of neurons
fire in sync
all together on the same beat. And there's a bunch of different beats that happen in the brain. Some of them are slow, like one beat per second, and that's when you're sleeping. If you're beating around 10 beats per second, like maybe you're sitting next to a campfire in an Adirondack chair, or on like the totally other end of the spectrum, like some neurons fire at 600 beats per second.
What are they doing?
That I have no idea.
And all this is going on in your head simultaneously?
Yeah. No, that's the cool thing, is that when all of these beats in your brain come together, that's when you're able to process the world and understand it as it exists as human beings.
Huh.
But getting back to our story, when your brain is doing something really tricky that requires super focused
attention, working memory, and so on.
You're like trying to find your way home from the subway station, or if you're in a new city, you know, navigate around it. There's a certain beat that sort of rises above them all. And that is
the so-called gamma frequency.
This range between 30 beats per second all the way up to 100 beats per second.
And this gamma frequency has been considered to be very important for the higher order cognitive function.
And the interesting thing is that when you look at an Alzheimer's brain, what you see is there's actually less gamma happening. Or people say like the power of gamma is reduced.
Not all the neurons can be recruited to oscillate at the gamma frequency.
It's still there. It's just quieter. It's like you turn the volume down.
Right.
All right. So just to briefly sum up here, what we've got is a rhythm, which we call gamma, which is used when we have complicated or higher thoughts in the brain, which when you got Alzheimer's kind of gets saggy or tired.
Yeah.
Or
yeah, totally. And of course, obviously, in an Alzheimer's brain, there's a lot going on. And this is just one of the things, right? You've got the plaques that build up around the neurons.
The stuff that gucks up your brain and makes it hard to think.
Yeah, totally. It's like cobwebs in the brain. And then the connections between neurons gets all muddied and immune cells get messed up. But Li Weitai was like, forget all that. What would happen if I just bring the gamma back?
Yeah. We decided to just manipulate gamma oscillations.
And how do you do that?
Well,
hello.
Technology.
Hi, this is Molly. Hi.
Technology you can find at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
We're walking into the Big Hour Institute.
It's a big shiny glass building.
Molly, hi.
Eventually, Li Weitai came striding into her office to meet me.
My understanding is that you want to see some of the experimental setup.
And so Li Wei led me down the hall to this tiny room.
Okay, so...
So here's what they did. They get some mice.
We started off with a mouse model.
Mice that have an early stage of Alzheimer's disease.
With multiple notable defects.
Do they have the gunky plaque stuff in them yet, or is that later?
No, but they do have
elevated levels of beta amyloid peptides,
which is this protein that forms the plaques. So it's like basically pre-plaque gunk. But the important thing to Li Weitai and her team is that they have less gamma going on in their brains. If you remember, the whole plan here is to bring the gamma back.
Yes.
So to do that, they get what might be the world's tiniest drill, and they drill a small hole into the skull of the mouse. And then they take a really thin fiber optic cable, they slide it through the hole into the brain. And then they get this laser of blue light
to flicker
at 40 beats per second.
Gamma frequency.
And they turn that on, and the light travels down the fiber optic cable deep down into the brain to this group of cells that they've modified
in the hippocampus
to be sensitive to light. So when this pulsing light hit these cells, they actually began to fire at 40 beats per second.
At gamma frequency.
And they would keep these cells firing at gamma.
For 1 hour.
Firing.
And then after 1 hour,
they turn off the light. And then eventually they started looking at the brains of these mice, trying to figure out if anything was different after the light flashed. And they see,
to our much surprise,
we're not expecting this at all,
we found,
after they shot this pulsing light into the brain, there was suddenly nearly half as much of that soon-to-be nasty plaque gunk stuff that was filling up their hippocampus.
Half
of the stuff was just swept away.
Yes. 40 to 50% reduction of beta amyloid.
That just seems crazy.
This is crazy. Yeah. I mean, we were just so surprised.
Do they know why the flood of
light
would
so
turn out?
The pulsing light somehow triggered the brain's cleanup crew.
Microglia.
These cells in the brain that are called microglia.
You can say they're the janitors of the brain.
And in a normal brain, these janitor cells usually gobble up the gunk.
But in Alzheimer's disease, it's known that microglia, then they don't sort of function normally anymore.
It's like these janitors just sort of
stop cleaning up
and go on strike.
There we go. Okay, cool.
Okay, so we're looking at a screen that's now flat. It's not. When I was at MIT, one of Lee Wei's grad students.
My name is Anthony Martorell, second year.
Was showing me side-by-side comparisons of these mice brains on a screen.
Can you guess what that is?
Which part?
The green things.
Microglia.
Microglia, yeah.
And you see,
after 1 hour of gamma.
Wow, so that, yeah, that part.
The microglia. The cell seems a lot bigger.
Clearly see these round bodies.
Yeah. And also, the belly seems to have more amyloid.
Oh, like they're doing more eating.
Yes, they go back to eat more amyloid again.
It's like somehow making the neurons fire turned on the sanitation system in the brain.
But the most wild results.
Wait, there's more wild?
Oh my God, you gotta hear this. Because
okay.
What I'm about to tell you, you may say, no, I don't believe it. It's science fiction. Okay. So,
one of the things Li Wei and her team were starting to think was that drilling and fiber optic cable
is very invasive, right?
You'd never be able to do that on a human.
Exactly. So we started to say,
well, what if we can get the light into the brain in a different way? Like, maybe we could go through the eyes.
So the hole in your head would be your eyes instead of a hole in your head?
Yes.
Mm.
So Li Wei and her team created what I like to think of as the flicker room. Wait, is this the room?
This is the room. And
okay. It turns out, I learned upon my visit, it is just a storage closet. You know, you have a, just like a plastic table. Very DIY.
Yeah, it's a plastic table you can buy at Target.
There were some plastic shoebox-sized containers lined up on the table for the mice. And then,
can you see the strip?
Around the edge of the table.
Basically surrounding all the cages.
Are duct taped strips of LED lights.
And the reason why we use LEDs is because a regular light bulb, it can't flash fast enough.
And so the idea is, what if we just put the mice in this room and just let the light flicker at 40 beats per second.
So you want to show Molly, like, turn this on?
Yeah. And so we turn off the overhead light in the room, so it's very black. And then, oh, wow. The room was now glowing with this white LED light.
Okay, so the light is turning on and off 40 times a second.
It's so there's, you know, you don't see anything going like on or off. It just looks like something's
exactly
on, but it kind of feels like my eye is twitching.
Exactly.
And so it's blurring the light a little. Just on the edges though.
Yeah, just on the edges.
And so they put mice in this room for an hour and just let them kind of bathe in this glow.
And guess what?
What?
We look at the amyloid beta levels in the visual cortex, and we found there is a 50% reduction.
50%?
50%
just
reduction.
Just from shining light in their eyeballs?
Yes.
Wait a second. They didn't do any drilling in their skulls or anything?
No, they didn't drill. They didn't tweak the mouse's brain cells to be sensitive to light.
They just filled the room with occasional LEDs flashing at a particular frequency?
For an hour.
Now do you see? Are you going to tell me I don't believe it? It's science fiction.
And they followed this study up with another study, which was done in the same way. So the same flicker room, light through the eyeballs. And only this time they put the mice in there for 1 hour a day for 7 days. And they took mice that had full-blown Alzheimer's. So this is like cognitive decline. They're forgetting things and they've got hardened plaques in their brain. And they see the same thing. Nearly half of the stuff was cleared away.
Wow.
Half.
Wow.
It's just flickering light in front of the mice.
That's the shock. I mean, that's the shocking thing. The thing I didn't understand after talking to you about your study was, I was like, why hasn't everyone done this before? Like, why didn't everyone go, we should just shine light through eyes?
See, well, you know, that's really the most unexpected and exciting aspect of our study, which is something this simple, yet you know, it has never been done before. You know, that
one of the things, one of the caveats here is that if you don't do the Flickr Lightroom every 24 hours, the level of gunk in the brain starts going back up again. And so now they're trying to figure out how they can keep those levels down, maybe even for good. So when we originally reported this in 2016, it was all breaking news. It was off the record. Since then, Li Weitai has gone on the record, and she and her team have expanded their experiments to include sound. So it's basically the exact same experiments, but with sound at the gamma frequency.
So wait, do we know what it sounds like?
I have it here.
Oh.
So I'm going to hit play. Oh, okay. My God. It's kind of a crazy sound. I almost don't want to hit play. Okay. Three, two, one.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It's like a little insect boring into my brain. And there's like a sub bass in there that's making my stomach like, ugh.
Right? The first time I heard it, I like ripped my headphones off my head. And then I then really converted and found it super soothing.
I'm not there yet.
Okay. God, and I think we should probably also do the caveat of like, there could be some way in which this comes through your headsets in a weird way. It depends on where the speaker is set, yada, 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 where this is not the sound.
Yes.
In a and way I, that they are totally. Playing.
And maybe we'd even want to take it a step further and say, do not use the sound.
Yes, please do not use this sound at home to self-treat. They were playing this for mice. And when they were playing it for mice, they were able to see very similar effects as when they did the flashing lights in the Flickr room.
If the mouse no longer has quite as much junk in its head, does that mean that it can remember things that had happened to it, that it gets mentally more acute?
Yeah, that is their big next research. That's
so they
what
don't
they're,
know.
They don't know. That's what they're, that is now the next step. But nobody really understands how plaques and the gunk buildup in the brain relates to memory and cognition. And the dogma in the field is that when you have Alzheimer's, you can't form new memories. And once you lose a memory, it's gone for good. But there is another group at MIT that is actually sort of challenging that assumption that you can never get a memory back.
Because the patient could never tell us, we all assumed the information had to be gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we'll get to them, but first we have to go to a break.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon slash not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out, and thanks.
Hey, Jad here. We are back, looking back at Molly Webster's piece from 2016, peppering in some updates as we go. We're going to keep rolling here with the original for a beat, and then we'll get more from 2020 Molly and me in a little bit.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Molly Webster.
This is Radiolab.
And we're back.
And just before the break, you said that there may be a way to bring a memory back from the Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. to pull the memory back into place.
Yeah.
Why are we so quick to jump to the conclusion that the information was somehow completely gone?
And the person who said that to me is this guy.
I'm Dheeraj Roy. I'm a fourth-year graduate student in the Susumu Tanigawa Lab.
Over at the Tanigawa Lab, they were thinking, what if we could figure out exactly where the memory should be in the brain and just give that spot a little bit of juice?
Right.
So they took some mice that were just starting to lose their ability to remember things, and they thought, okay, let's try to give them a memory.
We put them in a box that has a particular smell, some sort of lighting, mm-hmm. and some texture on their feet.
A little mouse carpet or...
That's exactly what it is.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Okay, mice on carpets. Got it. The point is, the box looks and feels and smells different than any other box they would hang out in.
And then you give them a light electrical shock.
And the mice... They just freeze.
They don't move at all.
Which is a sign that they're afraid.
They hate the box.
And for the rest of the afternoon, which is a very long time in mouse time, they go on hating the box, which means with the carpet and the light and the smell, if you put it back in there, it'll freeze because it remembers the shock.
Yes.
But...
A day or a week later, which...
When these same mice were put back into the same box...
Instead of being scared of the box, they would just continue investigating as if nothing happened. They could not remember.
So Dheeraj and his team did what Liwei did. They got some modified mice, and then they put a little hole in their head. They slid in a fiber optic cable. They shined some light to trigger the neurons that they think hold this memory. And they
in
were...
In the fear section.
Near the fear section. So leading on the path to the fear section.
So we do this.
And then...
Put them back into the box.
The box with the particular lighting and smell and carpet.
And ask... Is there any change in their behavior?
Will they act afraid again?
Do they show any more memory? And they did. They showed recovered memory.
Wow.
Whoa.
So that's like, bam, that memory's in there.
Exactly. Voila. The behavior is back.
You can dig up the memory by shining light in the right place?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was always under the impression that the memories were totally lost.
Right. So I think that's not just you. I think that's essentially the entire field, what you described.
Okay. Well,
just because...
That's good.
Because the patient could never tell us, we all assumed the information had to be gone.
Huh.
So one of the things to say is that Dheeraj did tell me that, you know, all of the experiments they did are in mice that have early Alzheimer's. The thought is, though, is that once you get to the late stage of the disease, there's enough damage in the brain that you really wouldn't be able to get those memories back.
That might be right, that a memory lost is just lost. But, you know, when you have someone in your house and you live with this disease day in and day out, the disease just goes its own way.
Mm-hmm.
And it can... puzzle you or frighten you or suddenly declare something new that you didn't expect. So, for example, my dad had it for about 9-10 years. It was a slow act of disappearing that he did. Where, I mean, the last time my father came to was so far into the disease, he hadn't spoken for a year and a half. He was sitting at the table for the Passover Seder. And there's a song that you sing, and it goes, Dai, dai, yenu, dai, dai, yenu, dai, dai, yenu, dai, yenu, dai, yenu. So it's just a chorus. And from out of nowhere, this being at the end of the table who I knew was my father, who hadn't spoken in a year and a half or two and had not spoken coherently for three, suddenly flew into the song. And sang the song full-throatedly at the table, like the reappearance of some just last figment of himself. And it was both horrifying and extraordinary. Both, you know.
I mean, I think that's the fact that maybe some information still persists. Hopefully someday we could kind of, maybe there's something we could do. But yeah, this is all in my mind at the moment.
As long as we can figure out how to rebuild the pathway to retrieve the memory, then I think there is hope.
And then I want to jump in here with one more part of the sound update, which is that Li Wei and her team in particular are thinking about it in regard to capturing memories. Because where this research probably gets even like more interesting is when you do the light flashing and that sound at the same time.
We eventually just decided, why don't we, you know, put the two together and see how the animals respond.
This is becoming like a mice spa. And when they did that, they saw this gamma beat in the brain, but not just in the auditory cortex or the visual cortex.
Not just in one particular brain region. Now we are seeing across different brain regions.
So the hippocampus got involved and the prefrontal cortex got involved. And then there was the neocortex and maybe even the parietal lobes. So there was like activity like all across the brain.
Is it a little bit like a whole bunch of like clocks coming into yeah. sync?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And imagine thinking it's only going to affect one clock, but it actually somehow pulls them all into synchrony. Hmm. Again, they saw the microglia doing their cleanup thing all across the brain, but they also saw almost like a rebuilding of neuronal circuitry. So like the synapses between neurons seem to improve.
Then basically this repaired the disrupted neural circuitry. And I think this in turn can lead to recovery of learning a memory.
Basically, in a way, she's done something very similar to what Dheeraj has done, but with her own light and sound technique, and the memories came back.
That's so interesting.
And the mice show very impressive improvement to their cognitive ability.
So it's almost like two things happening, which is you're seeing physiological effects in the brain, and then you're seeing the layer on top of that, which is then the memories that live in the physiology are also having some impact.
Yes.
So with all the stuff, super new, so I feel like it's caveat time.
You know, I personally think the most important question is whether humans respond similarly.
I mean, keep in mind that both Dheeraj's study and Li Wei Tai's are in mice, not humans.
Right. So
do you have a thought that like why, like, is there a reason that a human neuron might react differently than a mouse?
The thing is, I think especially, you know, in Alzheimer's field, I mean, people got burned a lot.
There's there's like a 99.6% failure rate in moving something that seemed to work in mice to humans in Alzheimer's.
99.6?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a study that came out in 2012.
That's a horrible number.
So I just got to be really conservative
I'll
here.
I'll dial it back.
You know, what we have in mice, they're just... so exciting and so unexpected. But, you know, I'm going to keep my mind open when it comes to humans.
And so here we have my final update, which is that Li Wei Tai and her crew have started human trials.
So we indeed managed to get an IRB approved for our first very small scale study in early stage Alzheimer's disease subjects.
They're doing a clinical trial with 15 Alzheimer's patients.
How far into the study are they?
So we have recruited 15 individual people. We basically installed our light and sound device in their home.
Really?
So they themselves or their caregiver can turn on the device.
And then they sit there and they get the light flashed in their eyes and they get the sound flashed at their ears. And they're doing it an hour a day for 6 to 8 months, maybe 6 to 9 months. And they're just collecting data. And I guess we're going to see.
You know, we are talking about living human beings. It's not that we can just take out their brain and see their microglia or, you know, all of this. But we are evaluating all of the subjects in terms of their cognitive ability. And we also do MRI scan to look at how active their brain activity is.
And do you have any intel on what they're seeing so far?
Nada. I wish.
I mean, every step of the way, to be quite honest, it's always a surprise. It's like, oh,
yeah,
this can do, you know, gamma can do this and gamma can do that.
This is the glorious part of all this. This organ of ours, the brain, is so crazily complicated with, like, whatever, 100 trillion connections or whatever it is. There's so much chance there's going to be a lot of surprise.
Yeah, it's like almost even if it doesn't lead to any treatment in humans or something super concrete, it's like we know this little secret about the brain now. And there's something that feels like beautiful in that.
Yeah, I'm actually setting this up for my Christmas tree.
Are you really?
Yes. Yeah, I just bought the new LED lights, and they can flicker a different color with different colors.
Oh, so each individual bulb can travel through colors, but while they're doing that, they're going to be flickering at 40.
We're going to have a very therapeutic Christmas.
In the Liwei Tai household? This is the tree in your home.
Yes. Yes.
I want to have an eggnog next to that tree.
Yeah.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled babbel.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Well, today...
Yes.
The story of an axe-wielding nun coming through a window to smack some staphylococcus and take you back to the future.
Exactly. The story comes...
Does that make any sense? I don't
well,
know.
Well, it will.
Okay, it will.
The story comes in two parts, both from our producer, Latif Nasser, and here is part one.
So, the way the story goes, it starts in 1928.
1928. Alexander Fleming, the story goes, who knows if it's apocryphal or not, is growing staphylococcus, in his lab.
That's Marin McKenna. She's a science writer. And staph is a bacterium.
It lives on our skin, and it especially likes parts of the body that are warm and damp.
So it likes to be just up our noses or...
In our genitals or in our armpits, places like that.
And generally, it's no big deal. Doesn't really do us any harm. But if it gets into a scratch or a cut and makes its way inside our bodies...
Staph goes from being this benign companion to being potentially deadly.
Anyway, London, 1928.
Fleming is growing staph in his lab.
In these little petri dishes. And he was a slob, basically. And he goes on a vacation, leaves his petri dishes covered in bacteria just around, leaves his window open.
And something blows across his lab plates.
Some tiny little speck of a thing just floats in through the window and comes to a rest on one of those petri dishes.
And so a few weeks later,
Fleming, finally, back from vacation.
He needs to use those lab plates again, and he and his assistant go to clean them off.
I mean, you'd imagine that he would seed some real lush, nice, furry lawn of staff just overflowing right out of the plate.
Because it's been sitting there for so long.
It's been a staff party.
But on one of the plates that they pick up, they realize that it's almost polka dot. It's got little dead zones all over it.
Little patches where the staff is dead.
Dead patches. So something blew through the window, landed in the dish, and starts killing the bacteria.
Yeah, and so when Fleming looks down at his plate, he sees that at the center of these, you know, staff dead zones, there's a
tiny speck of natural mold.
Of mold.
And they realize that that mold is expressing a compound that is killing the staff around it.
It's like emanating rays of death.
What was the compound?
That compound was called
penicillin.
The first true antibiotic.
Infectious diseases that had been killing people for as long as we had been people suddenly could be stopped.
And it just blew in through the window?
That is the story that's always been told.
However it got there, it was amazing. It was a miracle.
It was called a miracle drug, right?
I mean, it really was a moment when the world changed. When Fleming was put on the cover of Time magazine.
This was 1944, height of World War II.
It was a picture of his face, and the banner on the cover said, "His penicillin will save more lives than war can spend."
But, and this is, I had no idea about this, virtually at the exact same time when Fleming's face is on the cover of Time magazine, like 2 months later, this Stanford researcher publishes that he has found 5 different strains of staph that do not respond to penicillin.
Really?
Yeah.
This is happening while he's on the cover?
Virtually the exact same moment.
And it's the first sign that staph has responded to the penicillin in the world by developing resistance.
It's almost like
set producer Soren Wheeler.
The era of penicillin was over before it began.
Almost before it began.
Before it's even released to the general public.
Wow.
And that penicillin-resistant staph moves across the globe.
And in 1957, in Cleveland, some scientists gather together.
And they are in a panic. They have no idea why they've lost the antibiotic miracle so quickly.
So scientists across the globe put their brains together and try to come up with a new drug.
The next amazing thing.
And in 1960, they get it.
Methicillin.
And it works.
For about 11 months.
11 months?
Whoa.
And so we started this arms race.
There was a bug, and then there was a drug that took care of it, and then there was a better bug.
Drug bug, drug bug.
Right, exactly.
I actually found this list. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay, so streptomycin, 1943, resistance 1948. Methicillin, 1960, resistance 1961. Clindamycin, 1969, resistance 1970.
Wow.
You can think of it as leapfrog, or you can think of it as a game of whack-a-mole.
Ampicillin, 1961, then 1973. So that's a little. Carbenicillin, released 1964, resistance 1974.
They're getting better. They're getting better.
There were always more drugs. You know, the drug development was doing really well for a really long time.
Piperacillin, introduced 1980, resistance 1981. Hmm.
But after the year 2000, drug companies begin to realize it's not really in their best interest to make antibiotics anymore.
And the end I have on this list is linezolid, which is introduced 2000, resistance 2002.
Wow.
And there are a few more, but you get the idea.
Antibiotic approvals, the entry of new drugs to the market, just kind of fell off a cliff.
Why?
Well, it takes 10 years and $1 billion to get to the point where the drug is marketable.
But as soon as you get the drug on the market,
the resistance clock is running.
So you probably won't make your money back. And as you've probably heard, we now have these situations.
Well, a frightening new warning from the Centers for Disease Control about the spread of a string of germs
where literally nothing works.
So-called superbugs are now turning up in hospitals in
and the patient dies.
There are now bugs that can resist all of our drugs.
I have seen physicians break down weeping over this. It's not the way that medicine is supposed to fail anymore, but it does.
I mean, I know that possibly the origin story of penicillin is apocryphal, so this is all a little suspect, but, you know, just to enjoy imaginings for a moment, like, it just seems like if that happened, let's just open up a bunch more windows. Just something ought to blow in.
But we could wait a long time, right? I mean, staff had been around for millennia before 1928.
Yeah. Well, actually, there is this story about these two women who did open a window to an alien and distant land. And actually, in a way, it's a story about reimagining the past. But to me, it's a story about a friendship. Okay, so you have...
Hello, I'm Dr. Christina Lee.
Christina.
And I'm an associate professor in Viking studies at the School of English at the University of Nottingham.
She's a historian. And then you also have...
Hi, I'm Freya Harrison.
Freya.
I'm a research fellow in the Centre for Biomolecular Sciences at the University of Nottingham.
And Freya's a microbiologist. She studies bacteria. We'll start with her.
Okay. So most of my work is about sort of looking at how bacteria evolve during very, very long-lived infections. But... my big hobby is Anglo-Saxon and Viking reenactment. So I had a purely sort of amateur interest in the history and mainly in dressing up as a warrior and going to Fight Club every Wednesday night and learning to use the weapons.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is actually not Freya's group. This is a group in New Jersey, but basically they do the same thing. Hundreds of people go out into, you know, some field with some dulled weapons.
Everything from swords, spears, axes, and... we give each other a jolly good bashing and have a good time.
Well, it was really a nice sort of coincidence, really. So
2012. A few years after finishing her doctorate, Freya goes off to work at the University of Nottingham.
Nottingham's one of the places in the UK, not only for microbiology, but for sort of Anglo-Saxon and Viking history.
And she goes there to study microbes, but she figures, hey, why not, while I'm here, brush up on my old English?
I'd studied some old English to a level where I could sort of read and speak a little bit.
But she figured, hey, she could be better. And if she did, she would get deeper into the whole reenactment thing.
So I rather cheekily emailed the School of English's Old English Reading Group.
That's where she met Christina.
Yes.
The historian.
And I thought Freya...
At one point, Christina the historian asks Freya, like, what do you do? And Freya said, you know, my day job is that I'm a microbiologist, but on evenings and weekends, I'm... history nerd. And Christina said the moment she heard that,
I just kind of thought, I've found my kindred spirit here.
Because she was like, wow, I'm like your mirror image, because I'm a historian by day, but by night, I'm a microbiology nerd.
I've been interested in infectious disease for quite a long time, which I don't find any kind of friends in my department.
So eventually, they start talking about historical diseases. So, like, how would people back then have treated something like, you know, Ebola? Freya is especially interested in this because she, for her historical reenactment, is developing this nun character who goes off and heals people. But anyway, so they're talking back and forth, and then to cut a long story short, they find themselves both interested in this one particular book.
It's known as Bald's Leech Book. So this is about 1,100 years old.
Bald, is it B-A-L-D?
It is, indeed.
And leech, like a little worm that grabs onto your and sucks your blood?
No, it comes from the Old English word lecher, which is actually a healer or a doctor.
So the little squiggly animals are called leeches because they're medicinal, not the other way around.
Oh.
So the doctor wasn't named for the leech was named for the doctor.
Exactly, yeah.
And Bald is a man, the guy who wrote the book?
We think it's a guy's name.
And what is this book?
So it's kind of like this old healer's handbook. It's filled with these potions and cures.
The original manuscript is in the British Library.
Locked away.
But 21st century, very kind people have digitized the original Old English text and put it online.
So Christina and Freya bring it up. And they start going through all the remedies.
And, you know, it describes to you remedies for stuff that is a little bit different. You know, things like...
Fone deovol, fone manon.
Possession by the devil.
Which, according to this leech book, the remedy for someone who is possessed by the devil is you...
spua drank, lutre.
Make this kind of like foul brew. You make them drink it, and it'll make them... vomit out the devil.
And then things like
Yifmon sea torana.
How shall we say, make your husband more physically attentive or less physically attentive, whichever you, whichever direction you need to moderate it.
Pig's blood, I hope, or toad blood.
Drink on neacht nestia.
Actually, it's just you boil a plant in some water and give it to the guy.
Oh.
Yeah. So Frey and Christina are going through this leech book, looking for some kind of wound.
Something that was clearly an infection.
Some pussy something.
Something we could clearly say that's bacterial.
And eventually they find an entry
where at the end of the recipe, it says in Old English,
Sebetsta lachdom.
The best medicine.
The best medicine.
Hmm.
Yeah, move over laughter.
Yeah, and we thought, how can we not try this one?
What was the best medicine for?
So it said it was for a lump in the eye.
It's actually called wen in Old English.
Yeah, of course, that could be something like a wart, right?
Mm.
But there is a suggestion by archaeologists that eye infection was rife amongst the Anglo-Saxons because
really?
You lived in buildings where you had smoke going on, you lived cramped together.
So it could also be a sty.
What is a sty?
It's an infection of an eyelash follicle.
You rub it and it itches and then it gets swollen.
And it causes quite a nasty red lump.
It's a sty in your eye.
Sty in your eye. Now, it just so happens that the bacteria that causes the sty in your eye is
Staphylococcus aureus.
Staph.
Oh, the same stuff as the Mr. Window Man, Penicillin Man.
Exactly.
And we just thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a bit of spare time and a couple of hundred quid to buy the ingredients and just give this a go?
Yes, let's give it a try.
You know, why the hell not?
And matter of fact,
look at this place.
We thought that too.
Studio.
Not bad.
Recently, producer Matt Keelty and I went to my tiny apartment in the city and
all right.
We tried to cook it up too.
Are you ready to cook?
Oh, I'm ready to cook.
I've got this recipe here
if
you'd like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, please read it. Go for it.
Okay, it goes like this.
That's the first line of the recipe, and right off the bat, for Christina and Freya, there's a problem. That first ingredient...
The word kropliach.
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 Christina said it was quite difficult to translate.
Nobody quite knows, you know, what it is.
But luckily...
Just a couple words over... was a clue.
And garlic.
The second ingredient.
Garlic, which is an allium species, and kropliach.
We know this was another allium.
That's what the Dictionary of Old English tells us.
So they figured probably what they were dealing with was an onion or a leek.
But we didn't know which one. So we thought, okay, we'll try one that has onion and one that has leek.
Now, the recipe doesn't call for this, but we did it anyway. Peel the onion. Chop it up. The same for the garlic.
And the recipe, it doesn't tell you how much. It just tells you equal amounts of.
So you take out the measuring cups, you measure out equal amounts.
Yeah, equal amounts. Into the pestle.
And then after that.
Okay, it says.
E canua well. Tosomne.
Pounded well together.
Okay.
So you have to be really pounded. And pounded Freya did.
Yeah. So, Lots of time with a mortar and pestle. Muscles built up from wielding a sword for pounding the ingredients.
Look, it's starting to be more of a mush.
Third ingredient?
The next one was definitely something you wouldn't have knocking around in your kitchen.
And feares, yealan bea emfela.
Ox gall.
Ox gall.
Bovine bile from a cow's gallbladder.
What do you have to kill the cow and then go reach?
No, it's actually a very standard ingredient in microbiology labs.
Ox bile.
You can but should not just buy it on the internet.
Here we go.
And so you take the ox bile, add it to the onion and garlic.
And then the fourth ingredient.
Ye neem
wine. Wine.
And wine time. Red wine, white wine, what kind of wine are we talking about here?
This is the thing. So we had quite a discussion about what type of wine should we use, and we don't know really, did they have red wine, did they have white wine, what was the alcohol content? But I did a bit of detective work.
And she figured out that the monastery where this leech book was written, well, she figured out where their vineyard was.
And just down the road, there's this modern organic vineyard.
So they used that wine.
Cavicchioli and Figli.
I just want to point out how difficult it is to find English wine. We had to use Italian, but... Once you get all that stuff together, you're onto the final ingredient.
The fifth ingredient was actually that you're specifically told that you have to mix these ingredients together in a brass or a bronze pot. I don't have one. So we had to sort of add pieces of, you know, of copper that would have been available to people at the time.
So they had to do some research, but they figured out that the copper of today that is most like the copper of a millennium ago was actually
cartridge brass, which is what's used as standard in plumbing fittings.
Dropped a few pennies in there.
We actually use pennies.
Do I stir it?
I think I stir it.
It's like a world's worst cooking show.
It looks and smells like quite a nice summer soup.
Oh,
that looks awful.
Oh, that's so gross. Clearly, we botched this whole thing.
Let us stand the neon nicht on them Arafata.
And finally...
All right, so we're going to cover it.
Okay, we're covering it.
The directions say we have to let the whole thing sit for a while.
It has to be stored for 9 days and nights.
Okay. That's it.
One day goes by, 2 days, three, four, five...
Six, seven, eight, nine.
All right. 9 days later.
All right, here we go. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, here we go.
And
on them Arafata, our ring through cloth.
Then you have to strain it through a cloth. The liquid that comes off you apply to the person's eye.
Oh, the liquid.
And nicht do mid
feather.
With a feather.
Say betsta lachadon.
Now, clearly we didn't have any staff to try this out on, but Freya in her lab, she made these mock wounds.
With these little plugs of collagen, so it's a bit like jelly.
Basically, it's like a goopy substance made to be kind of like a flesh wound.
And we infect these wounds with bacteria, with the staff.
Then they put this 1,000-year-old recipe that had been standing there for 9 days, they put it on the bacteria that was in the fake wound.
We didn't think this was going to work.
No.
We thought, you know, well, given the ingredients, we might see some small killing effect on the bacteria, but it won't be anything to write home about.
They thought maybe it'd kill 10%, 20% of the bacteria. But then when they came back the next day...
It was a staph massacre.
It went on a rampage. It went on a staph rampage.
It was killing, you know, 99.99999% of these bacterial cells.
What?
Yeah. First, we thought we'd made some sort of mistake, and this was some kind of fluke. You know, we'd accidentally mixed up our plates or mislabeled something.
So, they run the entire experiment again. They grab the ingredients, mash them up, put them on some bacteria, and it happens again.
Just absolutely wiped out the bacteria in
killed
these,
them
these
dead.
Fake wounds.
Then they tried a third time and a fourth and a fifth, and it works every time.
And this is just something you really don't see in your career as a microbiologist.
And eventually, they escalated from just regular staph to MRSA, to the methicillin-resistant staph. And this is one of the bad ones.
The superbug. New government data estimate that about 2,000 people are dying of community-based MRSA every year.
This one is very dangerous.
So Christina and Freya, they sent some of Bald's brew to one of their collaborators in the States.
Our collaborator, Kendra Rumbo, in Lubbock, in Texas.
Kendra took the stuff, put it on some MRSA bacteria, and then a week later sent Freya and Christina an email.
And I think it was actually a three-word response. I think she just simply said,
what the fuck?
What the f***?
Bald's best medicine had just wreaked havoc on the MRSA. It killed 90% of them.
This is beyond our wildest dreams.
Now, Frey and Christina made very clear that this is not yet a miracle drug. I mean, it's not even being tested in humans.
So absolutely do not do this at home.
They don't even know if this is safe.
It might be that if you don't do it in exactly the way we did, nasty fungus could grow in it, give you a worse infection.
So,
we should not have done this.
Matt and I, we dumped ours down the drain. But the thing about this whole story that is so intriguing and so cool to me is this time travel thing, which is so strange. Like, it's like the idea that something 1,000 years ago, like a bullet forged 1,000 years ago, we could use it now, and that it could work. The time travel dimension of that is so weird to me. It kind of makes you think differently about, I don't know, progress.
So, without much further ado, Dr. Christina Lee and Dr. Freya Harrison, and they're going to talk to us about some ancient biotics.
For example, just a few weeks ago, Freya and Christina got up in front of the Royal Society of Chemists.
Thank you very much, and it is an absolute pleasure to be here.
Large hotel conference room, 100 or so people. Freya actually got up on stage dressed as a nun.
Okay, so this is one interpretation of what an Anglo-Saxon scientist may have looked like. So
and they presented the results.
Next ingredient. It is particularly
they did the cooking demo. And then at some point, Christina said something really interesting. She was like, okay, sure, we want to write this off because it has demons and dragons and elves in it. But are we sure that we know what they meant by those words? Like, for example.
There are remedies which ask you, sing four Ave Marias.
And we would say, oh, that's so superstitious. This is all in their heads.
But there again, we should also remember, this is a period when people do not have watches. You do not have your nurse, you know, so that's got the watch. Everybody knows the Ave Maria. Everybody knows the length of an Ave Maria.
So maybe it's take this medicine and wait 20 minutes, and I know how to standardize 20 minutes, which is...
Three Ave Marias, four Ave Marias.
That's fascinating.
It may appear one way, and it in fact could be a totally different way.
It suggests that in order to time travel, you have to somehow... God, it's like we don't even have the language to be able to understand what they were doing.
There's a phrase, the past is a foreign country.
Likewise. We need to learn the language of the doctors of that time. We need to kind of be a little bit less dismissive and learn a little bit more, you know, stuff from them. I learned a bit of humility this way.
But here's the reason why this is so confusing to me. So 1,100 years is a crazy long time for humans. And for bacteria, that's like an exponentially crazy long time.
Yeah.
So how is it that something that this man Bald was doing to these bacteria then, like it's not even the same bacteria.
Yeah.
How could that even work?
That's an awesome question. So one thing we've got to think about is, well, why did these medicines drop out of use? And maybe it's because when they were used, the bacteria evolved resistance. But now, 1,000 years later, when these medicines have not been used, you would expect that resistance to be lost.
This is something that Maren McKenna mentioned to Soren and I, that sometimes when you take a drug out of circulation...
Sometimes... resistance will decline. That doesn't always work, but sometimes resistance does decline. So if we had been using this compound through the ensuing 1,000 years, then maybe it wouldn't work.
So there's an interesting discovery there, like that what worked once and then was resisted, you give it a rest and it can work again, and then it will be resisted, and you put it to rest, and if you had enough different... if you could go to different places and the different paths, to go to China, where they now got all these people studying Chinese cures and Arab cures, you could come up with a rich historical cocktail of armamentariums that will work if you bring them in, take them out, bring them in, take them out. And the whole world of the past then becomes the fruit of your future, sort of.
So it's also like now I have suddenly an image that it's possible that
this is Soren Wheeler, by the way, in conversation with Maren McKenna and Latif.
That 1,000 years ago, these folks went through what we went through with penicillin, in that this guy wrote something in the book, and it's actually called The Best Medicine. He probably got on the cover of whatever their version of Time was.
He got their Nobel Prize.
And everybody celebrated. And then years later, styes were coming back, and the garlic wine didn't work anymore, and they stopped using it, and it got put away, and then here we are, and we discover it, and it's been put away long enough that, like, then now I'm thinking about some future civilization digs up an old medical textbook that was in some dusty whatever and discovers penicillin, and it works. Did I lose you on that, Maren?
No, I'm still with you. I don't know how. It seemed like such a great hypothetical construction. I just didn't really know what I could add to it.
Sorry.